Accession number 10295, reel 11.
Mr. Lane, reel 11.
I'd previously met a pilot, Flight Lieutenant Pollitt, a young lad, and he had said that the next day he was going to Rangoon, and if I looked out for him, I could fly in his plane. It was the old Dakota. No seats, just the bare boards, bare floor. And as I said, there's this, we was all paraded, and there's this wall with the bars running across the top and the ropes hanging down. And it never dawned on me for 1 minute what those ropes were for. And I'd got what meagre bit of kit I've got, which was me, a pair of trousers and a shirt they'd given me. I had slippers, I had some pumps on, that's right, I didn't have socks. I had a little wallet with all my belongings in, photographs or stuff that I'd managed to carry with me. The main thing I had was a roll of army toilet paper. And on that army toilet paper was the name and regimental number of every man that I had sounded the last post over or bedded. And on top of that, I gave a rough description of where he was, you know, either Chunkai or Nicky or wherever I'd bedded him. And so that list I lent to the War Office after the war for them to lend to the Graves Commission. They never ever sent it me back. I wrote to them several times, but they never sent it back. But I'm going off the story. This wall with the ropes hanging on, it never dawned on me what it was. The RSM that was detailing us off to the different planes was detailed up into, I think, parties of 30 or 40 to each plane. And I was about to go walking over with my party, and the sergeant major stopped us and he said, before you go, you've got a duty to do. And I said, what do you mean? He's got a duty over there, not just to me, he was talking to all of us. And over on the wall at the side, attached to these ropes, were four Japanese soldiers, and they were stood on a wall. And we were supposed to go over there and take a brick away. And each one of us had to tick a brick away until the man was hanging. And I said, you're not on. No way, I'm not on, you know, not interested. He said, you're not getting on the plane till you do it. And most of the other lads were of the same opinion. You know, as far as we was concerned, it was over. We'd finished. It had gone, you know, we wanted to go home. And
you weren't interested in revenge?
No way. But one or two of the lads were, you know, the thickheads. But what happened was that this lieutenant, to this pilot that I had met, he came walking over to me. He said, come on, get in the plane. And the sergeant major said, who the hell are you? And he said, piss off, this man's with me. And as I walked, the other gang walked with me, and we went on to this Dakota. We got on, there was about 20 of us, it should have been 40, but there's 20 of us got on the plane. And he said, right, I'll take you up the railway, let you have a look at what you've built, and then we'll go to Rangoon. So he flew along the railway for us, showed us the signs, the sights, and then we dropped down in Rangoon, and we'd never more surprised in our lives to see the aerodrome. The Yanks apparently had built it, and it was completely metal, just rows and rows of strips of metal that we landed on. And as we got off the plane, I don't think we was on the ground more than 2 seconds, 3 seconds, before a bevy of women came over, all neatly dressed with Red Cross uniforms, etc. And two to a man guided us over to some tents. And we got in the tents, and they were all laid out with tables. Sandwiches of every description. Salmon, you know, you name it, there were sandwiches there. Ice cream, cream, fruit, you name it, the food was there on the table. And big tins of cigarettes, hundreds and 200 cigarettes in a tin. To me, you know, at the time we wanted to eat and eat, but as soon as we started eating, we knew we couldn't. We'd have been sick. But we had what we could out of it, we took our fill, and then we went from there to the hospital at Rangoon, where we were in the hospital, I think, for 3 days. 4 days. But anyone who had had malaria, they had to stay on. I was one, I'd had, I'm not sure, I think 100-odd times I'd had malaria, but nothing ever really serious, you know, just the shivers. So I stayed in there for a week, and then from there they took us out, put us on the canvas, to wait our turn to come home. And that's when Chris Colgan came to me and gave me these Japanese dog tags, you know, to bring home with me. And at the same time as he gave me that, the bandmaster, Bandmaster Gray, he came over and brought me bugle. I'd had it confiscated by the Japanese before we went up to Utaradit. They said that if I took a bugle up to Utaradit, I could play signals out to the British Army in Burma and they would come down and attack. You know, there was no way. I don't think I'd understand any of our calls anyway. But that's what they thought, so they took the bugle off me. But fair enough, they took it off me, but they kept it and gave it to someone to pass on to me when I came home. I appreciated that. That's in the museum now at, Ashton Underline. That bugle sounded the last post, to my knowledge, 3,000-odd times. I've since built up a list. And of the regiment I was with, the Manchesters, we went into battle with 980 men when the war started. When we came home, there was 440 of us. And today, I believe there's about 120 left. Can't be many more. When we got home, back to England, it was bloody stupid, really. I came back in October, the end of October, and they gave us 6 weeks leave, so it couldn't have been October, it must have been November, no it was October, that's right, they gave us 6 weeks leave, and I got a recall to barracks to report to Blanford Camp in Dorset on the 22nd of December. I'd been absent from England for just over nine years. It was my first Christmas at home when I had to report back for duty. So I reported back on the 22nd of December, and on the morning of the evening of the 23rd of December, morning of the 24th of December, I deserted the first time in my life I'd ever done anything, you know, wrong. I deserted, me and two more lads, and we came home to have Christmas with our families. And then the 29th of December, we reported back to Blanford. We couldn't be charged with, because there were no officers there to do anything. So we had to wait until the 2nd of January. I got 7 days extra duties. Norman Berry, the other lad, got 14 days CB. And the third lad got a court-martial. We all three done exactly the same thing, deserted. So for my sins, I was transferred to Royal Corps of Signals from the Manchesters. I was no longer a responsible soldier. I ran away, so I was transferred to Signals. I wasn't bothered, really. My job then was, I went up to Catterick for training. I was promoted. And my job then was training girls how to use a telephone, a switchboard and a teleprinter. And I did that for another 18 months, 2 years. And then my time was up. I came out. I would have signed on, but no. I think everything had changed. The army wasn't the same anymore.
Why not?
I think they suddenly got officers in who knew what it was about. They suddenly got thinking people in. Whereas before, we hadn't got any thinking people. Everything had been done on the spur of the moment. You made your rules as you went along. You know, but now you couldn't pull the wool over anybody's eyes. It's changed completely.
When did that come about?
Immediately, round about 46, 47.
Did your period of imprisonment change you in any ways?
Well, I didn't know it at the time, but I do know now because I'm on a war pension. I attend a psychiatrist every 2 or 3 months. he's trying to find my brain. When he does find it, I hope he tells me where it is, because I could use it now and again. But to myself, you know, I don't feel it all that much. But if you ask my wife, she'll tell you a different story. I still have terrific nightmares. I still get depressions. When I get depressions, I don't hit anybody, but I shout at the dog. I don't try and take it out of anybody. I'd rather do what I'm doing now, talk or write. More often than not, I'll write something stupid to the newspapers. I think that's the only way it's affecting me. I'm bitter, very bitter. I'm bitter at mostly the people that I served with, that they themselves have accepted it as if there's nothing happened. You know, they still look on the certain officers as good blokes. And I personally couldn't stand the sight of them. I couldn't stand being in their company, certain officers and certain people. The certain men that I know that were Jap-happy, as we call them. Jap-happy is a person that bows and scrapes to a Japanese. It's a thing I never did. And anybody who did do, you know, they were the lowest, they were the scum.
Was it that experience with the officer and the two sergeants, really, that made you most bitter?
I think that, plus the three lads being shot, made me very bitter. And then another thing that made me feel very bitter was in Selarang, where the Japanese had they'd put us all into this Selarang barracks. It had been built for 800 men. And there was about 22,000 of us in there to sign a parole. Well, it's a load of bloody rubbish, a parole. You can sign whatever you want. And I don't see any reason why it should have gone through all the trouble that it did. Because immediately after signing the parole, several people tried to escape anyway. But it was made to, I don't know, such a blather about it. You must do it, it's a code of honour. You've signed to say you won't escape, so you mustn't escape. You know. Well, there's nowhere we could escape to anyway, but this is what we were told. You know, to me, it's a load of bullshit.
Who do you feel most bitter against regarding the Selarang Square incident?
The Selarang Square incident, I don't know. I think it's the officers in general. You see, the Selarang incident, all the generals have been taken away. They were all taken to Formosa. The only officers that were left were colonels. There was Toosey, Ebbomes was a senior, and one or two other colonels. And between them, they could have got their heads together and said, look, what the hell, let the men sign. You know, if they don't want to sign, well, they don't want to sign. All you got to do is put Tom Mix on it and Jack Jones or whatever. The Japanese didn't know you. So why all this honour and, you know, be honourable to your country and, you know, if you've said you're not going to escape, you're not going to escape. It's a load of bullshit. Because all you had to put, as I say, was Tom Mix.
Do you feel bitter against the Japanese?
I feel bitter about them for the methods and the way they went about it. As fighting soldiers, I think they're unqualified. They were absolutely fantastic. Possibly because they were stupid. See, the difference between the British Army and the Japanese Army was the Japanese fought as an army. The British Army fought as battalions. You know, and this is the difference between it. We were fighting for our battalion, not for our country. You know, they were fighting for the Japanese army, Japanese country. If a man was transferred from, we'll say, the Manchesters to the Loyals, unless he was very well known, he was looked on as one of the black sheep. Keep him on one side. In the Japanese army, if a man is transferred from one unit to another, then he's just transferred and that's it, and they go along with the stream. You know, and that's the difference between us and them. Another thing with them, they knew what they were fighting for. They knew they were fighting to kill. But we didn't. We did. The Manchesters, the East Surreys, the Loyals, Argyles, Gordons, we'd all experienced some form of active service, either on the Northwest Frontier, Palestine, you know, anywhere like that. We'd all experienced it. But the lads, the young lads who were sending us out there, were what we call white skins. You know, they'd not even been in the army 5 minutes. And then it all goes back to the same one, Mr. Churchill. I mean, when Singapore fell, the Australians asked for their men back. And Churchill pulled them out of Burma. He pulled the Australians out of Burma and sent them back home to Australia. They pulled them out of the Middle East and sent them off to Australia and replaced them with Yanks. He only replaced them with Yanks because he could afford to replace them with Yanks. When Pearl Harbor happened, when the first bombs fell on Pearl Harbor, Churchill didn't turn around and say, oh, bloody hell, what a loss of life. He jumped up in the air and said, oh, great, that brings America into the war. He wasn't concerned about how much it had cost.